Okay, well, this is the review of part one continued. And I think I said last week I thought it would take 3 weeks. Well, at the rate I'm going, four maybe. It's probably more like it. So
certainly shouldn't take more than, what, 36?
Shouldn't take more than 36 weeks to review it all. Although, yeah. There is that danger, like I told you about the person who takes 2 hours to explain the hour and 50-minute movie, what happened in it to you. So, okay, well, last week I mentioned that the very first week after Mary's arrival in Scotland on the 19th of August, 1561, she called for an interview with John Knox. I was intending to skip over it, and then the interview, but I thought we should cover at least part of it, because part of it goes very directly to the relationship between the church and the state. So after a brief discussion of whether or not Knox had raised her subjects against her authority, okay, in other words, against the Queen Regent, right, rather than Mary directly, and why he had written against the rule of women in that book, First Blast of the Trumpet Against the Monstrous Regiment of Women, and whether or not he was a necromancer, that was a rumor going around in France, the conversation moved on to the following. This is Knox's account of it. That's the only account we have. Yes, Mike? Necromancer? Yeah, like a warlock or a witch or something. In other words, kind of laughable, but that's, she had heard that was how he did, was able to accomplish all these things. So, okay, so, but yet, said she, you have taught the people to receive another religion than their princes can allow. And how can that doctrine be of God, seeing that God commands subjects to obey their princes? Madam, said he, as right religion took neither original strength nor authority from worldly princes, but from the eternal God alone, so are not subjects bound to frame their religion according to the appetites of princes. For oft it is that princes are the most ignorant of all others in God's true religion, as we may read in the histories as well before the death of Christ Jesus as after. If all the seed of Abraham should have been of the religion of Pharaoh, to whom they were long subjects, I pray you, madam, what religion should there have been in the world? Or if all men in the days of the apostles should have been of the religion of the Roman emperors, what religion should there have been upon the face of the earth? Daniel and his fellows were subjects to Nebuchadnezzar and unto Darius, and yet, madam, they would not be of their religion, neither of the one or of the other. For the three children said, we make it known unto thee, O king, that we will not worship thy gods. And Daniel did pray publicly unto his God against the express commandment of the king. And so, madam, you may perceive that subjects are not bound to the religion of their princes, albeit they are commanded to give them obedience. Yea, quoth she, but none of these men raised a sword against their princes. Yet, madam, quoth he, you cannot deny but that they resisted, for these that obey not the commandments that are given in some sort resist. But yet, she said, they resisted not by the sword. God, said he, madam, had not given unto them the power and the means. Think you, quoth she, that subjects having power may resist their princes? If princes exceed their bounds, quoth he, madam, and do against that wherefore they should be obeyed, it is not doubt that they may be resisted even by power. For there is no greater honor nor greater obedience to be given to kings or princes than God is commanded to be given unto father and mother. But so it is, madam, that the father may be stricken with a frenzy in the which he would slay his own children. Now, madam, if the children arise, join themselves together, apprehend the father, take the sword or other weapons from him, and finally bind his hands and keep him in prison till his frenzy be overpast, think you, madam, that the children do any wrong? Or think you, madam, that God will be offended with them that have stayed their father to commit wickedness? It is even so, said he, madam, with princes he would murder the children of God that are subject unto them. Their blind zeal is nothing but a very mad frenzy. And therefore, to take the sword from them, to bind their hands and to cast them in prison, till they be brought to a more sober mind, is no disobedience against princes, but just obedience, because it agrees with the will of God. At these words, the queen stood, as it were, amazed for more than a quarter of any hour. Her countenance altered so that Lord James began to entreat her and to demand, what has offended you, madam? At length she said, well then, I perceive that my subjects shall obey you and not me, and shall do what they list and not what I command. So must I be subject to them and not they to me. God forbid, answered he, that ever I take upon me to command any to obey me, or yet to set subjects at liberty to do what pleases them. But my travail is that both princes and subjects obey God. And think not, said he, madam, that wrong is done unto you when you are willed to be subject under God. For it is he that subjects people under princes and causes obedience to be given unto them. Yea, God craves the kings that they be, as it were, foster fathers to his church, and commands queens to be nurses unto his people. And this subjection, madam, unto God and unto his troubled church is the greatest dignity that flesh can get upon the face of the earth, for it shall carry them to everlasting glory. So, we can see actually in a capsule there the sort of initial confrontation between the Stuart rulers and the Presbyterian church in Scotland. And I think you can imagine this conversation, the themes of it go on through the reigns of James and Charles the First and Charles the Second. So, anyways, from here their conversation went on to Roman Catholicism, whether it was a true or false church. Okay, let's see. So this was August of 1561. At this point, you recall that the Parliament had met, and they had, before Mary came, they had settled some of the issues of the church in terms of the book of the Confession of Faith, but they hadn't settled the Book of Discipline, and furthermore, they hadn't settled the issue of financing the church. And now, today, it's completely out of our mindset to think about how we finance our church by we all tithe on our incomes and put the money in, and that's where the money comes from. At that time, they had this very elaborate system of benefices and where, because it was a feudal system, the landowners were required to pay so much to the church. A lot of the land was actually owned by the church, so there were church rents that came out of that. But there really wasn't any established way to pay ministers in general, because a lot of the money that was, quote, going to the church was actually going to nobles who had also held offices in the church. So, in February 1562, there was a plan for dividing the church revenues of two-thirds to the existing holders of benefices, okay, and the remaining one-third to be split by the state and the church. And that didn't leave very much for the ministers. And several years later, many of the ministers were suffering because there had been two very severe winters. And Mary was petitioned in June of 1564 to increase the share, and she said, that Her Majesty thinks it no way reasonable that she should defraud herself of so great a part of the patrimony of her crown as to put the patronages of the benefices forth of her own hands. For her own necessities and bearing of her great and common charges will require the retention of a good part in her own hands. So, she, basically she wanted to spend the money on elaborate parties and so on instead. Okay, in May of 1562, there was some further persecution of the Protestants in France, and Mary gave a ball for her foreign servants, which appeared to be in celebration of her uncle's successes in fighting off the Protestants. And Knox preached a sermon related to this, and that resulted in being called in again. During the sermon, he proceeded to lament the abuse which the greater part of the rulers made of their power, and introduced some severe strictures upon the vices to which they were commonly addicted. Their oppression, ignorance, hatred of virtue, attachment to bad company, and fondness for foolish pleasures. And he also said that the princes were more exercised in dancing and music than in reading or hearing the word of God. Okay, and delighted more in fiddlers and flatterers than in the company of wise and brave men. Okay, so Mary called Knox in, and she accused him of speaking irreverently of her in such a way that would cause her to be hated by her subjects. She'd only heard about the sermon secondhand. And so Knox actually ended up preaching it to her again. She still wasn't very happy about it. She wanted to be him to instead come in, as he said, whisper in her ear anything that he'd heard from other people instead of preaching it. Okay, well, to go much further on our review, we're going to come up upon the person of the Lord James Stuart, the Earl of Moray, who is Mary's half-brother. He was a son of James V. It's called a natural son. In other words, the mother wasn't the queen, but some other mistress. But as a youth, he was tutored by George Buchanan, who I guess we'll also come to. But George Buchanan was probably the foremost scholar and man of letters in Scotland at that time. James Stuart was one of the lords of the congregation, one of the nobles that was an enthusiastic Protestant. He listened to Knox preach. In 1555 and 1556, he was one of the nobles that requested Knox return from Geneva. When the Queen Regent was battling against the Reform in Perth and in the north of Scotland, he was one of the nobles, actually, who was leading in the battles. let's see, this one of Moray's biographers, Maurice Lee, quotes P. Hume Brown, a famous British historian. Of the two men, Moray and Knox, it was Moray who indubitably did the most to ensure the success of the Scottish Reformation. And Lee concurs with that opinion. Okay, I know this may seem strange. We always think about John Knox, and he's probably a very familiar name, and James Stewart, or the Earl of Moray, probably isn't. Just to quote a little bit from Lee, when Knox appeared on the scene in 1555, there were two questions to be answered. What form would the revolution take, and would it succeed? Knox definitively answered the first. Thanks to him, the Scottish Reformation became distinctively Calvinistic. He also helped to answer the second by supplying the new movement with the type of leadership without which it could not succeed. This leadership was not his own, but that of the feudal nobles whom he converted, for in Scotland only the nobility could ensure the success of a movement of any sort. Okay, so even though in a, say, church history, you know, we speak a lot about the church, the Reformation was not just a reformation in the clergy, but was also, very importantly, one of a fair number of the nobles. And that's what really, I think, in God's providence, allowed it to succeed in Scotland. Okay, April 1563, despite there being laws against celebrating Mass, prominent Catholic leaders celebrated the Mass in public. And the Protestant lairds of Ayrshire, which is in the west of Scotland, southwest, threw some in prison and wrote to the others that if they celebrated Mass, the lairds wouldn't actually complain to the Queen or to the Council, but take matters into their own hands and put them to death themselves. And again, Knox was called in by Mary, and she asked him, you know, will you allow that they shall take my sword in their hand? And complaining about this, that the lairds were basically usurping her responsibility, because she wasn't fulfilling her responsibility to punish these people celebrating Mass. Knox said, the sword of justice, madam, is God's, and is given to princes and rulers for one end, which if they transgress, sparing the wicked and oppressing the innocent, they that in the fear of God execute judgment where God has commanded, offend not God, although kings do it not, neither yet sin they that bridle kings to strike innocent men in their rage. The examples are evident. For Samuel feared not to slay Agag, the fat and delicate king of Amalek, whom King Saul had saved. Neither spared Elijah, Jezebel's false prophets, and Baal's priests, albeit that King Ahab was present. Phinehas was no magistrate, yet feared not to strike Cosby and Zimri in the very act of filthy fornication. And so, madam, your grace may see that others than chief magistrates may lawfully punish and have punished the vice and crimes that God commands to be punished. And in this case, I would earnestly pray your majesty to take good advisement that your grace should let the papists understand that their attempts will not be suffered unpunished. For power, by act of parliament, is given to all judges within their own bounds to search for mass mongers or the hearers of the same and to punish them according to the law. And therefore it shall be profitable to your majesty to consider what is the thing your grace's subjects look to receive of your majesty, and what is it that you ought to do unto them by mutual contract. They are bound to obey you, and that not but in God. You are bound to keep laws unto them. You crave of them service. They crave of you protection, defense against wicked doers. Now, madam, if you shall deny your duty unto them, which especially craves that you punish malefactors, think you to receive full obedience of them? I fear, madam, you shall not. Okay, so this is actually very strong language. Right? He's telling her that if she doesn't do her job, that she can't expect her subjects to obey her. And she was, of course, as usual, somewhat offended and left. So, Mike. Yes, Mary is Catholic, and she celebrated Mass in private. And in fact, when she leaves, in fact, sometimes even in the castle when she's gone, they celebrate Mass there and it causes problems. But Dave,
how Calvinistic or how reformed was Buchanan at that point?
I don't really know for sure. Yeah. Well, very shortly. My guess is pretty reformed at this point, because very shortly he was elected to be moderator of the General Assembly within a few years. I mean, earlier, like when he was as a tutor for Lord James Stewart and so on. I don't really know, but because he went to the continent back and forth several times where he picked up some of these ideas. So, don't really know. But very shortly from now, he'd be the moderator of the assembly, so presumably he was fairly reformed at that point. Okay, well, Mary's recall Mary was a very young widow, and there were a number of negotiations going on for her marriage. Candidates included the Archduke Charles of Austria, Don Carlos of Spain, Eric the 14th of Sweden, a French prince. Knox preached a sermon to the nobility, and let's see. Well, there is not one of you against, I'm just quoting from a sermon, there is not one of you against whom death and destruction were threatened who perished in that danger. I guess that's pretty safe to say when you're preaching to, unless it's a funeral sermon. But, and how many of your enemies has God plagued before your eyes? Shall this be the thankfulness that you shall render unto your God to betray his cause when you have it in your own hands to establish it as you please? The queen, say you, will not agree with us. Ask you of her that which by God's word you may justly require, and if she will not agree with you in God, you are not bound to agree with her in the devil. Let her plainly understand so far of your minds, and steal not from your former stoutness in God, and he shall prosper you in your enterprises. And now, my lords, to put an end to all, I hear of the queen's marriage. Dukes, brethren to emperors, and kings all strive for the best game. But this, my lords, will I say. Note the day, and bear witness after. Whensoever the nobility of Scotland, professing the Lord Jesus, consents that an infidel, and all papists are infidels, shall be head to your sovereign, you do so far as in you lies to banish Christ Jesus from this realm. You bring God's vengeance upon the country, a plague upon yourself, and perchance you shall do small comfort to your sovereign. Okay, now she was, of course, shortly to marry a papist, but it did bring a lot of misery. He doesn't mention it, but also brings a lot of misery on Mary. But anyways, word of the sermon again got back to Mary, and she called Knox in for yet another interview. And several times she says, "But what have you to do with my marriage?" And Knox's reply is basically that, when he's up in the pulpit, he's speaking for God, and that he has to speak what God wants him to speak. We shouldn't think that he was only offending Mary or Catholics, right? A certain number of the Protestants also thought he was going too far in commenting on Mary's marriage and so on. In fact, we'll get to it in a minute. The next year, there was a complaint in the General Assembly about it. 8th of August, 1563, Mary was out of town, and a mass was held in the chapel of the palace, Holyrood House. And the next Sunday, several Protestants went in and they disrupted the service. And when Mary came back, she had two of them arrested for forcible entry, violence, and riot. And there was a trial scheduled for the 24th of October. And Knox did, as he had done many times when things were at a crisis, wrote a letter to Protestants all over Scotland, calling them to assemble and protect the two. And when the letter got back to her, she, of course, was furious and thought this was something to hang Knox with. So they called Knox, she and her privy council, right, her cabinet, called Knox in to try him for treason. And by this time, partly because of his outspokenness, Knox had become somewhat estranged from James Stuart, the Earl of Moray. Among other things, we'll see Knox's sermons were felt to be an impediment to Mary's conversion, if you can imagine that. Church growth movement there. Okay. I guess Moray had acquiesced to Mary's desire not to settle the religious question with Parliament. Okay, so Knox was accused of treason for convocation of the Queen's her subject, and also Mary accused her of cruelty. And if you read, I did last time I covered this, I read some quotes from the trial. Started out pretty rough, but Knox was unanimously acquitted. He ably defended himself. And then at the next General Assembly of the Church, they affirmed that Knox was tasked to warn the brethren whenever any danger presented itself. So Knox's problems, again, weren't solely with the civil government. At that same General Assembly, some of the Protestant lords had some kind of official complaint about Knox's preaching and his prayers for the Queen, which, as I mentioned last time, depending on when you listen to the prayers, they sounded to, basically asked God to bless the Queen if God would be so kind as to change her heart. In that General Assembly, Knox offered to debate five propositions
which reveal a little bit about his thinking at the time, but thinking that was radically different from the thinking of the age, that it was lawful for subjects to refuse to obey the king's commands to kill innocent men and to rescue innocent men from the king's hands, that subjects who obeyed the king's commands to kill innocent men were murderers, that God had sometimes ordered subjects to arm against their natural kings and to take vengeance upon them according to God's law, and that God's people have executed God's law against their king, having no further regard to him in behalf, that if he had been the most simple subject within this realm. Okay. Now, today, those don't sound like such a big deal. I mean, we, you know, whatever we thought about our last president, I think we generally felt it was within our government's, you know, within our rights to, say, prosecute him if necessary. So, but in those days, those were sort of explosive and revolutionary concepts. Marriage negotiations went on. Morey and one of Mary's other counselors, William Maitland of Lethington, tried to find someone acceptable to Elizabeth. Right, why do we need to find someone acceptable to Elizabeth? It's so that Elizabeth would be favorably disposed to bestow the crown on Mary when Elizabeth died. Elizabeth, however, wasn't very cooperative. She first suggested that this Sir Robert Dudley, who was widely rumored to be Elizabeth's lover, that he could marry Mary, and but she was pretty indecisive. And Mary met Lord Darnley, and he was a grandson of Margaret Tudor, so he had a claim to the English throne. He was also a Catholic, and failing to negotiate with Elizabeth, Mary ended up marrying Darnley. And because of internal court politics and because of what was going on in Scotland, Morey saw his influence slipping away, and also that Protestantism in Scotland was in danger. Actually, he left the court. I think I somehow left that, cut that out of my notes in my endeavor to get this chopped down to size. The internal court politics involved the rise of an Italian named David Rizzio. He served as Mary's foreign secretary. He was widely suspected of being a papal agent, and he was handling all of Mary's dealings with the continent. And, with Elizabeth recalcitrant, Darnley and Mary evidently in love, planning on marriage, and with David Rizzio strongly influencing Mary, Morey left the court at Easter 1565. In fact, by this point, he'd realized that Knox was right, and Morey and Knox were then reconciled. And though they weren't always in complete agreement on everything, they were never estranged from each other again. Morey decided that drastic measures were necessary to save the Reformation in Scotland, and he began to assemble an army, but he had several insurmountable problems. First, because the Protestants perceived that Morey was fighting to keep his position and lands, and partly because a lot of the Protestants didn't realize there was a perceived imminent danger. He had difficulty raising enough troops. And a couple of the lords who joined in with him in this effort had obvious sort of personal motives that led some question to the whole affair. And though it probably would have been Elizabeth's best interest to help, she waffled. So he left the court and raised an army. In the meantime, he was declared a rebel and put to the horn. The armies sort of moved around Scotland, never actually coming into open combat. So this was called the chase about raids, because they just sort of went around. And about this time, Knox preached a sermon on Isaiah 26:13-21 that King Henry Darnley, listened to. And again, it bears on the issue of church-state relations, and he was preaching on Ahab. It says, "Ahab, as in the book of Kings is written, received many notable benefits of the hand of God, who did visit him in diverse sorts, sometimes by his plagues, sometimes by his word, and sometimes by his merciful deliverance. He made him king, and for the idolatry used by him and by his wife, he plagued all Israel by famine. He revealed to him his will and true religion by the prophet Elijah. He gave unto him sundry deliverances, but one most special, when crowned Ben-Hadad came to besiege Samaria and was not content to receive Ahab's gold, silver, sons, daughters, and wives, but also required that his servants should have at their pleasure whatsoever was delectable in Samaria. True it is that his elders and people willed him not to hear the proud tyrant, but who made unto him the promise of deliverance? And who appointed him and put his army in order? Who assured him of victory? The prophet of God only, who assured him that by the servants of the princes of the provinces, who in number were only 232, he should deface that great army in which there were 32 kings with all their forces. As the prophet of God promised, so it came to pass. Victory was obtained, not once only, but twice, and that by the merciful visitation of the Lord." And so it makes the point that God is sovereign over Ahab and also over Scotland. And then goes on, but how did Ahab visit God again for his great benefit received? Did he remove his idolatry? Did he correct his idolatrous wife Jezebel? You should be reading for Ahab and Jezebel, Henry, Darnley, and Mary. Because that's how Darnley was sitting in the sermon. That's how he was interpreting it. Did he correct his idolatrous wife Jezebel? No, we find no such thing. But the one and the other we have find have continued increased in their former impiety. But what was the end thereof? The last visitation of God was that dogs licked the blood of the one and did eat the flesh of the other. In few words, then, we understand what difference there is betwixt the visitation of God upon the reprobate and his visitation upon his chosen. The reprobate are visited, but never truly humbled, nor yet amended. The chosen being visited, they sob and they cry unto God for mercy, which obtained they magnify God's name and afterward declare the fruits of repentance. Let us therefore, that hear these judgments of our God, call for the assistance of his Holy Spirit, that howsoever it pleases him to visit us, we may stoop under his merciful hands and unfeignedly cry to him when he corrects us. And so we shall know in experience that our cries and complaints were not in vain. Now, those of you who remember what happened to Darnley and Mary know that this was, in a sense, almost like a prophetic sermon. Because I don't know, the dogs licked their blood, but they both died unnatural deaths. But Darnley believed Knox was speaking about Mary and himself, imagine that, by way of Jezebel and Ahab. And so they issued an order that Knox was forbidden to preach in Edinburgh while the king and queen were present. Let's see, Mary went on to seize more of his property and the property of a number of the Protestant lords who were in rebellion against her. And when he finally saw how bleak the situation was, Maury, along with a number of the other lords that were in rebellion, accepted Elizabeth's offer of asylum and slipped across the border into England. Maury went on the 6th of October, 1565. Okay, so Mary has succeeded in, I guess you could say, getting rid of a number of the Protestant nobles. And she continued her plan of overthrowing the Reformation. Now, some modern historians will say, oh, she didn't have a plan to overthrow the Reformation. But in fact, she did write a letter to the Pope telling him the time was ripe to strike at Scottish Protestantism. Somebody teaching class on Scottish church history ought to be able to say the word Protestantism better than I can. Okay, so, some modern historians would say, oh, these are just sort of flowery words, you know, and so on. You could take different interpretations of Mary, and I believe she had a very high self-interest. Let's see, the English ambassador reported in February of 1566 that popery was flourishing and that royal pressure was being applied to the nobility to attend Mass. She had ejected Randolph, the English ambassador, later in the month. Presumably she was no longer concerned with coming to terms with Elizabeth, and she was hoping Catholics on the continent would help her achieve her goal of the English throne. Supposedly she had planned for a parliament in March to place Catholicism on an equal footing with Protestantism, but other problems of her own making would overtake her shortly. Many of you will remember that after she married Darnley, she was ended up being very sorry about it. They began to quarrel frequently. He drank heavily and slipped out of the castle to visit brothels. His father was pushing him to obtain the crown matrimonial. In other words, to be king in his own right, so that if, say, Mary were to die, then he would be king. Right now, he was just king as sort of a courtesy title. Mary wouldn't agree to that, probably wisely so. He became increasingly estranged from Mary, and that just increased his carousing. He gradually got pushed out of the business of being a ruler. Riccio had a stamp made with the king's signature, so he just stamped papers that Darnley hadn't even read. There were rumors that Riccio and Mary were lovers. Darnley may have believed this. But some of the remaining Protestant lords saw, you know, again, the drift of Mary's machinations to overthrow the Reformation. And Riccio was sort of a focal point for this. He had the queen's ear. He acted very arrogantly. He was a foreign secretary dealing with the Catholics on the continent. And he was resented by a lot of the nobility. A plot of some sort was hatched. And, you know, as often is the case, the details are somewhat hazy. But apparently, Darnley, together with some of the nobles, hatched a plot that they would kill Riccio, and then they were going to put Darnley on the throne, I guess, give him the crown matrimonial. So on the 9th of March, 1566, right before this parliament, Riccio was knifed to death by Darnley and several of the nobles. It started in Mary's presence. She was, you know, just aghast at it, and she thought she was the target, actually, of... not of the knifing, but that she was to see this and be extremely intimidated by it. But Mary, being pretty smart, decided to make up to Darnley very quickly, and that foiled the plot, because once, you know, she was sort of very nice to him and suckered him back into standing by our side, they, like, rode off in the night and escaped from the nobles. So the plot just fell apart. But nevertheless, she never really forgave him. That'll become obvious soon. Okay, she was also, at this point, she was, about 6 months pregnant. On the 19th of June, 1566, she had a son, James VI of Scotland, who would later become James I of England. So he was an heir to the throne. But her relationship with Darnley just continued to go downhill. She was approached by some of the nobles in November of 1566 with a proposition. They would find means for her to divorce Darnley if she would pardon the nobles involved in Riccio's murder. So now the one group that kind of got squeezed out are now trying to squeeze Darnley out. She agreed on condition that James's right to the throne wouldn't be threatened and that nothing be done against her honor. Some kind of plot went on. One of the nobles that was very active in the plot was the Earl of Bothwell. He'd been loyal to Mary throughout all of her recent trials. And in December of 1566, Mary had James baptized in the full Catholic form. The one was a large party. One noticeable missing guest was her husband, the father of the baby. Turns out he was suffering from what was apparently syphilis in a phase where it was disfiguring him. Mary did pardon Riccio's murders on the 24th of December, 1566. So some of them had fled the country and came back. Mary went to Glasgow on the 20th of January, 1567, to persuade Darnley to return and a convalesce in Edinburgh. And there, while convalescing in this house called Kirka Field, the house was blown up. So there wasn't not one stone was left standing. It was reduced to rubble. Darnley's body was found outside, but with no noticeable injury. It transpired that he had not been killed by the explosion, but rather had been strangled. Okay, there's all kinds of theories, and as you can imagine, this makes a lot of, for later writers, this is a fertile field for discussion. But at the time, the Earl of Bothwell was strongly suspected. I think probably did it, but widely believed today that he was the chief murderer. But Mary, instead of going after Bothwell, strangely enough, does the opposite. And Elizabeth wrote her a letter, says, "I cannot but tell you what all the world is thinking. Men say that, instead of seizing the murderers, you are looking through your fingers while they escape, that you will not punish those who have done you so great a service. I exhort, I advise, I implore you to lay your hands upon the man who has been guilty of the crime." Very good advice, but Mary didn't take it. First, Mary lived a sort of isolated life in some respects. She was somewhat surprised that public sentiment was quite the opposite. Started to appear anonymous posters accusing Bothwell and Sir James Balfour of murder and accusing Mary of being an assenting party. Mary, instead of prosecuting Bothwell, she gave him more castles where he was able to expand his power. In fact, he was now the de facto king of Scotland. Moray, who had come back to Scotland, left again. Said he feared for his life if he remained in Scotland. There was a private prosecution of Bothwell, not the Queen, but Mary basically intimidated the private prosecution, and so when Bothwell went to trial, there weren't any accusers, so he was acquitted. And shortly thereafter, and I'm skipping over a lot of events, the 15th of May, 1567, she married Bothwell in a Protestant ceremony. This was despite the fact that the Protestant minister objected to publish the announcement of the marriage prior to the event. Bothwell threatened to hang him, so... get around that. Okay, but meanwhile, public sentiment had really been whipped up to a fury. Mary appeared to be a conspirator in Darnley's murder. She excused and then married the murderer. Bothwell continued to consolidate his power. Some of the other nobles started to slip away from the court. An army was formed, headed towards Edinburgh. And Bothwell and Mary headed for the Scottish borders, which is where Bothwell was from. Mary never reached the border. She started to gather force to return to Edinburgh, but she was met by a much larger rebel force. And as they parlayed, her force slipped away, and she was forced to surrender at Carberry on the 15th of June, 1567. She was led back to Edinburgh, and she was actually told she could regain the throne if she disowned Bothwell. But she refused to do so. She was apparently quite surprised that the soldiers and people of Edinburgh were haranguing her for being a whore and a murderer. Okay, it seems she had misjudged the people's temperament. She refused to disown Bothwell and was also becoming quite irrational. Given the sort of rascal nature of the queen, the lords took her to a castle that was in the middle of a loch, Loch Leven. And they tried several times to get her to disown Bothwell and return. She refused and she remained imprisoned. Also, Knox and the other Protestant ministers were crying out for a trial and if she were guilty for capital punishment. So, after some time in captivity, about a month and a half, she was forced to abdicate. Meanwhile, someone had, Elizabeth had a sort of, you could say, conflicting concerns. On the one hand, she didn't think much of Mary. On the other hand, subjects rebelling against her sovereign didn't look so good to her. So she smuggled a letter telling Mary that she should just sign any agreement. If she signed it under duress, it wouldn't be considered to be binding. But she signed it on the 29th of July, 1567. James VI was crowned king, only a year old. John Knox preached at the coronation from the Book of 2 Kings on the accession of Joash, who was preserved from both Jehu and Athaliah. The Earl of Morton took the oath on behalf of the king that he would serve God, quote, maintain the true religion of Jesus Christ, the preaching of the Holy Word, and do in right administration of the sacraments now received and practiced in this realm, and shall abolish and gainstand all false religion contrary to the same. And out of my lands and empire I shall be careful to root out all heretics and enemies to the true worship of God that shall be convicted by the true kirk of God of the aforesaid crimes. How James was not exactly to live up this, you know, get to next week. Moray returned. He'd left the country, now returned. He actually visited Mary, his sister. She decided to designate him as regent, and he held that position for 29 months before he was assassinated. This did, of course, now all of a sudden create a climate in Parliament that was favorable for the reform. And the church met, the General Assembly met right about this time, 25th of June, 1567. George Buchanan was elected to be moderator. They met again in a special meeting on the 25th of July, and there a number of earls, lords, barons, and other commissioners subscribed a covenant to establish the church by law, restore its patrimony, in other words, its funding, etc. And plans were made for final ratification of the church by Scotland in the next Parliament in December. The General Assembly met again just prior to Parliament. Commissioners were appointed to represent the Kirk in Parliament. The man who married Mary in Bothwell was disciplined, the churches were now set for Parliament to continue establishing the church. Might wonder in this time, with all this upheaval with Mary, how did the church prosper? In 1560, at its first General Assembly, there had been 40 members and only 6 ministers. According to Hetherington, at that time there were no more than 12 Protestant ministers in Scotland. 7 years later, there were 252 ministers, 467 readers, and 154 exhorters. The readers and exhorters were sort of temporary offices of the church, men who weren't necessarily qualified to be ministers but would read and exhort. So the church had grown under very adverse circumstances. Okay, so the first Parliament met after under Moray's regency after Mary had abdicated. Quoting from James Hewison King, a historian of the Covenanters, this cleared the way for the reenactment of the Confession of Faith and for the passing of 11 acts as follows: on the abolition of the Mass, on the true church and churchmen, on presentees to churches, on the coronation oath, on public officials, on thirds of benefices, on schoolmasters, on church jurisdictions, on bursaries, on benefices, on privileges of churchmen. The tenor of these acts shows that the thoroughgoing nature of the revolution which had been accomplished and the foundations on which civil and spiritual government was to rest. The Reformed churches of this realm are declared in Act 6 to be the only true and holy church of Jesus Christ within this realm. While persons who do not accept the Reformed confession, subscribe the articles of religion, and take the sacraments are not members of the church. The settlement of pastors pertained to the church only, in other words, not to the government. The coronation oath was made imperative. Public officials were to acknowledge the Reformed church. The 10th Act asserts the legal right of the church to proper patrimony which is in the tains or tithes, and ordains the thirds to be paid to the long defrauded ministers. The 12th Act establishes just jurisdiction of the church. In this way, Scottish Protestantism had developed, organized itself, and set up its own autonomous government, and only after it asserted its freedom to act independently within its own sphere asked the civil power to recognize its separate existence. Magisterial recognition, indicated by the mutual acceptance of a creed, obviously limited that independence. Nevertheless, neither the king nor parliament could justly claim to have conferred on the national church an authority which is inherent, whereas in England the jurisdiction of the church is accepted as a gift from the crown, while it is held to be of a divine appointment at the same time. Okay, Moray had several serious problems still to deal with. Mary was in prison, but she still had her supporters. There was a king's party and a queen's party. Furthermore, some of the people who supported Moray was conditional. If Mary decided to disown Bothwell, they would support her. He was able to create sufficient respect for his authority so as to put a damper on any serious rebellions. 8 months into his regency, Mary escaped from Loch Leven, another exciting Scottish history story. She escaped to the west of Scotland and within 6 days raised a force of 6,000 men. Moray took a smaller force out and a battle began, but Mary's forces were routed. Mary headed for England. She basically slipped across the border, and there she was in prison. Some of her imprisonments were quote, guests of, you know, at certain castles and so on, but she was never released, and finally, 20 years later, she was executed. Again, Elizabeth saw her as a threat to her throne. Moray attended a conference with Elizabeth in Scotland, partly to determine what to do with Mary. When he returned, he found a number of lords in rebellion. He got the situation under control, but he made some enemies, particularly with one family, which took their revenge on him on the 11th of April, or 11th of January, 1570. He was shot by an assassin. Okay. Anyways, I think probably that thus ends the regency of Moray, and I guess we'll stop here, take some questions, and next time we'll begin on the other regents of James, and James is hopefully finish James's rule next week. So, questions?
What was Mary's husband doing at this time when Moray was choosing?
You mean Darnley or Bothwell? Oh, Darnley's dead. Bothwell, let's see, he fled at one point, and they first let him go, and then he fled. He'd had quite a colorful past, and unfortunately he landed somewhere, I think it was Denmark, where he had somehow jilted not the king's daughter, but maybe the king's brother's daughter or something like that. So he ended up in prison. He was tossed in prison. He died in prison. So, went insane, I think.
Mike. The idea of another man taking the oath for James VI of Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
Where would you get the sort of evidence to do that? I mean, this man saying, this is what this boy is going to do. Anybody taking that seriously would be a fool.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've read about it. I can't really tell you about a precedent or whatever, but I mean, clearly in Israel, right, they took covenants not just for themselves, but also for succeeding generations. All right, so when the Gibeonites came and sort of tricked the Israelites later, I think it was Saul, wasn't it, who was partly condemned for failing to keep that covenant that the Gibeonites had made with Joshua. So from that standpoint, I don't think I can't point to a more direct precedent, but indirectly, that's certainly a precedent for taking oaths that apply not just to you, but also to your successors. So.
It was probably the case with passage that Knox had cited at the coronation itself before he came to George Wigan.
Yeah.
It's not explicitly mentioned that the priest took an oath for him, but certainly the priest made him king.
Right, he was seven, so I guess even if he took an oath, you know, I mean, how much faith would you put in an oath that your seven-year-old took? Yeah, you're pretty good for Ellen, yeah. Margaret. Why 20 years? Because she actually wasn't executed for what she'd done up to the point when she was captured. She was executed for an ongoing plot to basically take over and become queen instead of Elizabeth. And of course, again, this is one of these things that, you know, historians debate about who was doing what and so on, but letters were being slipped back and forth, and Elizabeth had a big network of spies. Pretty fascinating story, but she was basically caught with rather incriminating letters. And so finally Elizabeth felt like she had, it's a little unclear, Elizabeth actually, after she was executed, complained about it as if she'd been forced to do it. Maybe she had by the law, but her advisors basically advised her to do it, so she did sign Mary's death warrant. I think so, yeah. I can't remember for sure, but so.
The idea of the Parliament coming in and
prosper the church there. And it seems to me that it's an exercise in futility because they can come right back and draw the next year and resolve what they are voted for. It seems to me the only way that you get any sort of longevity in this would be to take it. So it would take two-thirds of the ratifying, like our Constitution, otherwise it's four times next year.
Yeah, well, I guess you could say they're partly flying by the seat of their pants, not having a real model to look to in terms of reforming. Our model. Yeah. a little historic anachronism there. In fact, I think Mike's probably alluding to the fact that indeed later on a number of these things were overturned, but it was like the frog being put in a pot of water and then the heat being turned on. It was done slowly over time, so... Okay, well, let's stop there and...